Errol Ballantyne, driving you home with the music you love today on Radio Today.
And it is now 23 minutes to 4 o'clock, and in studio I am delighted to have with me the multi-award-winning, multi-talented star of South African stage. How am I doing, Jonathan?
The word multi is terrible.
He's speechless. Jonathan Rocksmith, and welcome to the studio. I'm very glad you were able to make it, and I'm really glad for your time because I know there are a lot of people who want to chat to you.
Oh, thank you, Errol.
I've just seen, I'm going to start sort of at the end, yep. And I want to go back to the beginning, but I've just seen Gertie, Noel and Gertie. I've mm-hmm. seen that performance, which was last week, Sunday, the week before. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. I was really knocked out by your performance because you're an actor playing an actor playing an actor.
Yes.
And it's very difficult to do because you have to get into these different genres. You have to put these different cloaks on and change. And your changing is very effective. Was it hard to get into the Noel Coward frame of mind? Because there were a couple of people who came on late, and you stood there in this Noel Coward character with this beautiful sort of, you know, how he spoke beautifully, and you interacted with the people who'd come in late, and it was all very much in character.
Oh, I'm glad.
How did you get into the character of Noel Coward? Did you watch his stuff? Did you listen to his music?
Look,
how did you do it?
I've always been a fan of Noel Coward. Yes. I'm a bit of an old soul in that respect. I've always preferred sort of vintage British theatricals and comedians. They're just, yes. Something clicks with me. I love that period. And I'm looking around today, and I think that period resonates with a lot of people.
Yes.
The Deco period, I think, evokes images of class and polish and
yes.
refinement.
So it's suave.
It's very, yes. it's, you know, it's sort of the precursor to James Bond in a way.
Yes.
And I've got all his books that he wrote. I know his plays backwards. I've got interviews with him. I've got master classes that he did, and I find him very fascinating. Mm. And the fact that this is this is the first character I've played other than Buddy Holly, who existed, was real. There's a huge expectation when you play something like The Phantom of the Opera, but there's an even bigger expectation when it's not relying on your coloring to bring a role to life. It's you have to do it this way. And he spoke very, very clearly. Like over, and that's the first step. And what's marvelous about him is he was the first genuine gentleman of the stage. You know, Porter was a little bit slimy in his way. Noel Coward just managed to make it accessible. And British humor can be alienating for an audience. And what fascinates me about this role is, as you say, people came in late and you can interact with them. And it breaks the ice immediately where they go, oh, he's kind of a nice guy, actually. He's funny. I understand him. He's using big words, but I know exactly what he means. And I think that was his secret. It wasn't necessarily what he said. It was how he said it that fascinates me.
And he was a character who came from nothing. He had a very poor background.
No, he was middle class.
Well, middle class, okay. He rose to be a kind of an icon in his day, wasn't he?
He was the icon.
He was the hero.
And he still is. You know, when people today, when they want to do a parody of British upper crust, it becomes a smoking jacket, yes. a cigarette, yes. and they stop speaking petty, clipped, you know, and it's fascinating to me that he still has an effect on pop culture today.
Yes.
You know, he was the precursor to Hugh Hefner.
Yes.
If you think about it in terms of the look.
Yeah, he was, absolutely. So, yes. Okay. Right, let's go back to the beginning, and we were saying just off air, I mean, you and I met 10 years about ago. I used to adjudicate various play festivals, and at that time, Jonathan was a school kid in not short pants, but he was in matric, I would think.
No, it was standard 8.
It was a standard 8. And you wrote a play which you put on, which I had the gall to stand up and adjudicate. I don't remember how I did with it. Was it okay? Did you get the feedback?
I learned a lot, and we adjusted it accordingly. But what was really nice about that play, I remember it specifically, it was called Dice Boys.
Yes.
And it was about a middle-class white guy who gets into a taxi.
Yes.
I had grown up in an area where due to financial situations at home, we have to take a taxi now and again. And, you know, in 92, 93, it was quite a thing. I remember it being quite horrifying to some of my mom's friends when they heard. They were like, what? No, well, you know, the car was broken again. We had to get to the shops or whatever. And I just remember getting into that taxi and feeling so welcome. And the driver was wonderful, and I basically recreated that moment. It was always with me. And at the time, I was staying out at Mulder's Drift, and there was a massive taxi rank. And the play came to me while we were filling up petrol, because a guy pulled up, and he had two furry dice in his taxi on the rearview mirror.
Oh, yes.
And he drove to the front of the entrance, opened the door, and a little old white lady got out. Yes. He'd driven all the way through the entrance so that she wouldn't have to walk too far.
Oh, okay.
I thought, wow, it's still like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, that's not the only thing you wrote. You've also written Hats Off.
Yes.
Look out for, who is it? Look out for Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah, that was Topsy-Turvy it was.
Yeah, Topsy-Turvy.
Yeah.
And how was it? How did you get the inspiration?
You know, again, I have an affinity for this British comedy. Also at Northcliffe High School, we did the Pirates of Penzance and the Mikado, which I think everybody did when they were younger. And those were the two most popular plays we did, operettas we did. And I thought, well, why? For an audience of high school kids who, as you know, as soon as you become a teenager, you know everything.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it still cool for them? And I went back and I looked at it again and I realized W.S. Gilbert was basically doing what Zapiero does.
Mm.
He's making fun of the political parodies and satire.
Yeah.
And it's Peter Dirk Ace put to music. That's how I always branded it, because it's exactly the same idea.
Mm.
So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do that today? But especially in a one-man format. You know, when Phantom closed, Peter Turin said to me, you know, you have to come up with something completely different, because you'd be a fool to follow Phantom with anything standard.
Mm.
He said, you either have to raise the bar or disappear for a few months. And I had this show that I'd written the year before, and I tried it out in Durban and Margate and a few places around, and it worked. And I thought, well, let's try. And we came in with the show, and at the end of it, it was the top grossing show of the year in that theatre.
Fabulous.
And set a new record. I think we ran at 98%. For
Fantastic.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah.
For Gilbert and you know, that to me was the biggest triumph. Because you had people from toddlers to people my age to people who possibly were contemporaries of Gilbert and Sullivan enjoying the show in equal measure. And the way that happened is we weren't precious. We didn't go around saying, well, we have to be strictly, you know, we have to be true to Gilbert and Sullivan, because if there's one thing that puts people off, it's a purist. We have to reintroduce our audiences slowly. I mean, if you want someone to eat blue cheese, you don't start them off on a Stilton. You start them off on a cheddar.
Yes.
And I had lots of fun with this particular cheddar.
Now, you left school. You went into Barnyard Theatres.
Yes.
Pretty much after school.
Basically, yeah? Barnyard was my university.
And then you did a couple of other things, but your big break was Handful of Keys.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Where did you learn to play the piano? Are you trained?
No. I tell you what happened is I was at Robin Hills Primary School, and we had a choir master called Chris McShane, and I've never been able to see him since. So if he's listening, you know, this is all on you, frankly. He noticed I had a bit of a curiosity with the piano. And what he would do is he would show me where certain notes were on the piano and show me where they were on sheet music. And in doing so, taught me how to read sheet music. And from there, I sort of worked it out. Because I usually play by ear, and I just worked out the rest. There are gaps here and there, but I mean, you know, along came... I remember the one day he came into school, he said, Jonathan, this is about 95, he said, I've just seen the most incredible show, it's called A Handful of Keys.
Mm.
And I said, when does it close? And it had closed that weekend, so I'd missed it. And I'll never forget this, he looked at me and he said, don't worry, you're going to do that show one day.
And you thought, sorry?
And 2008 came along, I was doing, in 2007, I beg your pardon, Ian von Memmerty gave me my first job in Greece at the Barnyard. And then I went into the Buddy Holly story, both directed by him. And we just clicked. Something, you know, people want to call it a mentor, people want to call it a father figure, people can call it whatever they like. The fact is, we met and it just worked. And he said to me one day, just offhand, how about you do Handful next year? And my jaw dropped. I said, without a doubt, I'm in. And I went into the show, and, you know, to be directed by someone musical and talented is one thing. To be directed by your mentor is otherworldly. Because across the piano, I have Roelof Culain, who is a pianistic genius.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm basically bookended by these two giants. And we start the show. And we completely changed the way people view the show, because it's younger now. It's an old product done in a new way. And I think that's where my inspiration with reinventing stuff came from. Because Ian said to me, the show's had its time as this. I wanted to go in this direction. Can you help me? And we worked with the three of us. And we came up with this product that became a perennial again.
And hugely successful.
And, you know, that was incredible. And yes. In the same year, I mean, talk about a bumpy year, I get an audition for Beauty and the Beast. Disney's Beauty and the Beast. And I knew the film well, and I knew there was only one role in there for me. That was Gaston. And I auditioned, I got the part, but the problem was, this is my favorite story when it comes to this, because it shows what a madman Peter Turini is as well. I said to them, look, I'm doing a handful of keys in Cape Town over the rehearsal period. Of the 5 weeks in Johannesburg, the middle three, I am in Cape Town. But Gaston's a small role, so if you just tell me which days you need me, I'll just fly up for them. Every day. So for 3 weeks, my schedule was this. I'd wake up at 4:30 to be at the airport by 5:30, to get onto the 6:30 flight, to be in Cape Town by 8:30, to be at rehearsal by 9:30, to leave at 3:00, to be at the airport by 4:00, to get on a 5:00 flight, to be in Cape Town at 7:00, to be at the show at 8:00. I did that for 3 weeks. It's the thinnest I have ever been.
Gosh. And you could have had all kinds of things going wrong in the meantime.
I missed only one flight.
Yeah.
And it was all through one time. And minus one flight of the 28 flights I did, one time got me there on time. I wish I could say thank you, but I can't do that anymore.
All right. And then the big one, Phantom. There are a lot of people, without going into all the details, but there are a lot of people who've seen Phantom all over the world. I've seen Phantom in the UK. I've seen you in the performance. There's no doubt that your performance is above anything that I've ever seen. And a lot of people have said the same thing. Did you go into it with a lot of trepidation? Did you go into it with a lot of confidence? Because you had huge benchmarks in the musical. How did you approach the thing? Did you say, I'm actually going to do this better than anybody, or did it just come from inside?
No, you know, I had a history with the Phantom of the Opera. My late granddad used to play the tape that we had, the cassette.
Oh yes.
I think it was 91 or 92. He used to have the cassette, and he would play it to me every Sunday. We'd have a family lunch. And we'd go sit in the Merc in the garage, because he just had a tape deck installed, you know, and that was fancy. Subsequently, I found out we were sitting in the car in the garage on a Sunday, because then we didn't have to wash the dishes. So we'd had it, and he taught me how to conduct to the score. So the music was part of my family life. I then, you know, 2004, the next year I'm going into matric. I need to figure out what I need to do. I'm passionate about the arts, but I don't know if I can. I go to the State Theatre, I sit in the front row, and I see The Phantom of the Opera with André Schwartz. Ooh. And by the time the curtain came down at the end, I knew without any reservations that that's what I wanted to do. And come hell or high water, one day I would be doing that show in that role, in that mask. Ooh. Cut to sort of 9 years later, 8 years later, my maths is bad. The auditions are coming. Phantom's coming back to South Africa for its Johannesburg premiere. Big deal. And everybody said to me, John, we know how passionate you are about Phantom, but you have to realize that you're far too young for the role. You could never do it. Mm. And I think anybody with ambition will tell you that is the only thing you need to hear. Mm. So off I go to the audition. My first audition came along, and I was offered Raoul as a callback. Mm. Little bit disappointed because, look, I'm grateful for the work, and I would have swept the stage in that show. I just wanted to be in it. Mm. Went back for the second audition, the callback, and the musical director said to me, well, how about we try Music of the Night? Do you know Music of the Night? And I've been working on the score for about 2 years. I said, I'll try. You know. And he said, fine, come back in February. We'd like to hear you sing Phantom. Do that. End of the audition period, I get offered Raoul 6 times a week and Phantom 2 times a week. Mm. Talk about having your bread buttered on both sides. Not only do I get to perform the role, but I get to be on stage singing basically the other half of the score for 6 days a week. Amazing. Unfortunately, due to several circumstances, André left our cast graciously and passed the baton to me. And I assumed the role full time eventually.
And we went into the dressing room and said, yes!
Well, I went into the dressing room for my gran. We both cried for about 10 minutes.
Gosh.
And then I got over that and did the show. But it was... it was one of those Hollywood stories. Mm. With the understudy, basically the story of Phantom of the Opera, the understudy goes on and has to. And I'll never forget it. I got a call that the first preview, we did a concert version of Phantom because the deck wasn't dry. There was something wrong with the paint. So we had to sit in chairs and do a concert version as our first performance. I'm dressed as Raoul. Andre is sitting next to me, as well as Magdalene, who was our Christine. And we do the show. And the next day, 12 o'clock, I get a phone call from the stage manager. The director would like to see you for notes. I said to her, you can't give me notes after a concert performance. We weren't doing the show. Mm. No, well, they're very insistent. So in I go at 3 o'clock. And I go into the... get goosebumps when I look back at it now. Get into the Phantom's dressing room. Sit in the Phantom's chair. All the while going, oh, Sunday. Sunday, I'll get to do this on Sunday. And they walked and they said, this has happened. We'd like you to be our Phantom indefinitely. Are you interested? Well, it was my little Hollywood moment that I had, and I'll never, ever forget that. Peter came in, and from that meeting onwards to the closing night in Johannesburg, he was beyond supportive, as was Andre. Gracious more than anyone else. And I got to live my dream. And no, I didn't go into it wanting to be the best ever, because there's no such thing. The Phantom will be different even if twins played it. Mm. You know, it's all got to do with how you perceive pain and loss, but most importantly, how you perceive unrequited love. That's what it all comes down to. It's not about vanity or anything. And I literally just went in there wanting to be truthful. That was my number one goal. And every actor says that, and it's a little bit wanky, but it's true. Mm. And that's what I did. And there were some people who didn't like it.
Do you know, the thing that impressed me about that whole performance was that you were kind of... you had your heart in your sleeve. You weren't afraid to show the emotions. You almost cried at one point in the production. Mm. And it clearly showed you were feeling what you were singing about. And I was watching your hands. I don't know whether you worked... I don't know whether you worked on your hands or whether it was a conscious movement, but you know, hand out to Christine, and just the way you held your hand out was different to anything I've seen. Was it conscious?
You know, I've got a friend at home who says to me... you had lots of hand magic. And do you know what the bottom line is? My perception of the man was, he's a musician. He's a genius. And geniuses live in their own worlds. And everything he did was basically, he was conducting everything he did. So it was more of a tribute to my granddad, to be honest, that my hands became so part of the performance. But when you've got half your face covered, and in Point of No Return, it's just a black cloak, and it's just hands. That's all you see. I did watch a lot of Leonard Bernstein, who was, for me, he's the number one conductor in the world.
Yeah.
He could express things just with his hands that was outstanding to me. And in my research for the role, I studied a lot of disfigured people, burn victims and such. And what happens is they become even more expressive because they have to in order to survive. And this becomes a lifeblood.
Yes.
And for this man who isn't used to contact or anything, his hands deflect the attention from the face and the disfigurement, and it becomes here. And it becomes a different take on it, sure, but the tribute to the writing is you can do just about anything with that role, and it will still work because of the writing.
Well, you're being very modest about it.
No, I'm being absolutely
truthful. You know, your performance was absolutely outstanding. I get shivers just thinking about some of the things that you did on that stage. If you just joined us, we're talking to Jonathan Rocksmith, talking about his life and his performances, and we move now from, because we're running out of time, Phantom. Now we're looking at you've been on tour, haven't you?
Just come back from Manila.
Yes, and
we were there for 10 weeks.
Was it interesting? Different? Very good.
It was different in that they've never seen Phantom before, so I was able to present the Phantom to people who had never seen it before.
Yes.
So every moment was fresh. You know, the chandelier, people were jumping out of their seats trying to get out the theatre, not realizing it's part of the show. When I climb out of the angel, there were shouts and screams. So it was so wonderful to see what it must have been like in 86 when Crawford stood on that stage for the first time and did it. It was amazing.
Mm. Voice training. Have you had voice training?
Mr. Nicholas Nikolaides is a genius and the most patient man I've ever been trained under. If it were not for him, I wouldn't have sung 8 shows a week of Phantom. Hands down.
Did you have formal singing coaching? Did you go for months or years, or was it just kind of ad hoc?
Like I said to you, the Barnyard was my university and my training. For 3 years I was there, because those audiences, if you're not great, they will let you know.
Absolutely.
And that was the best training ground for me. And I've done about 6 musicals now with overseas teams. Mm. And each person comes along and gives you a new sort of skill vocally. So I like to think that I'm still in training. Mm. I'm always going to be in training. It's just one of those things. I'm not one of those trained actors or vocalists or anything. I don't purport to be at all, because I don't think you ever graduate.
But you see, for me, unless you've got the latent talent, the basic ability, and all of those things that are wired correctly, it doesn't matter how much training you get. I don't think you're ever going to get to a point where you have this innate ability where it becomes completely natural. Your singing is pretty natural. Your acting is unschooled in a lot of ways, but it's absolutely from the heart, and it really works. And for me, that is just that is the pleasure of watching you on stage. I think you're a master of your craft, and you don't have a certificate that you can wave that says it's university.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I've never put much stock into training.
Yes.
In this particular job, because it's a physical, a practical art form, and I've never understood, and this is where I put my head on a block here. I've never understood theoretical means for a practical art form. It doesn't make sense to me, unless it's combined with a practical outlook. I do lots of reading. I do lots and lots and lots of reading and research to find out what the developments are and the different styles and that. But nothing beats being on a rehearsal floor with a director who's saying to you, yeah, but it's actually this, or try it this way, or... So, no, I...
It's the practical school.
Absolutely.
Could we ever expect to see Jonathan in a doublet with a sword doing Hamlet, or is it all about the musical theatre?
It's not all about the musicals at all. I mean, that's why I'm so happy doing Noel and Gertie, which is essentially a play with a bit of music. Mm. It's not a musical. It's a play. It's a story. It's a character. I've always been passionate about Shakespeare. Always. I had a wonderful English teacher, and then I met Matthew Ribnick, who was the most incredible, it was in Grahamstown. He did a lecture on Shakespeare, and I don't think we've even scratched the surface with Shakespeare in this country. And I think we can. I really think we can. So, no, the only reason I've never done a Shakespeare is I've never auditioned, and I've never been offered.
Hmm. But it's something you could explore.
Absolutely.
All right, just in closing, the future is huge for you. You've really only just started after 6-7 years.
Sure.
You've had some massive successes, and there are plenty more. Is there a role that you think and dream about? Having played Phantom, it seems like a dumb question, but is there a role that you know of that you'd think I would kill for that role?
My top three roles have always been Phantom, Jean Valjean,
yes,
in Les Mis. If we're talking musicals, Jean Valjean and Sweeney Todd.
Oh, right. Okay.
Those three, you know, all sort of troubled men. They're the most fun to play, obviously.
Yes.
But in terms of theatre, I would love to do Stan in Streetcar.
Okay.
Love to do that one day.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Are you going to stay here? Are you going overseas? Are we going to lose you to the Great White Way?
You know, it's not that simple. Equity is a big problem overseas. Mm. And the only way a South African can get work on the West End without a British passport is to be either invited for an audition or to go over there and slog it out for two years to get some sort of work that you can scrape together to get an equity pass.
Mm.
Other than that, it's not a case of just packing up and leaving. Also, this is my home. It's my home, and I would rather explore the versatility that our performers here are fortunate enough to have and exploit for their own good, quite frankly. It's a two-way street. Before going anywhere else, I'm getting so many different feathers in my cap here in terms of opportunity that I think I'd be a fool and a little bit ungrateful, actually, to just pack up and leave. You've got ballsy producers like Peter Tureen. You've got
wonderful material.
Absolutely. You've got gracious people like Ian von Memmerty. Why would I?
At this point in time, as
you say, I'm still a baby. I don't think I've made it to in any way, shape, or form. I'm still finding my feet in this bizarre job. But it's what I've chosen to do, and that's what I'm going to do.
Jonathan Rocksmith, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I wish you lots of good things, and I hope you go from strength to strength, and I look forward to following your career with great interest on the stage.
Thank you, Errol.
Thank you so much.
Errol Ballantyne, driving you home with the music you love today on Radio Today.